Hi, I'm Sue, an alcoholic. Wow, a few people came in since I looked back there. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. I think she's going to be a speaker versus a discussion leader. I think she's going to tell us her story. And you know, today, well, yesterday actually I started, Dawn asked me to do this, and I kept thinking, what can I say that's not the, you know, normal thing? And I even went on the internet and looked up bad sponsee to see if I could find something that, you know, might be something to say about Lynn. And apparently that's not a very funny subject because I couldn't find anything about that. But I guess a bad sponsee would be one that doesn't work the program, and that's certainly not Lynn. I've seen her grow. I've seen her change. I've seen her grab hold the principles of this program and work them, apply them through really tough times and through really good times. She is the type of person that absolutely positively makes my life a better life. You know, sponsees never seem to quite get that, how much they bring to us, and she definitely adds to my life. And she's both in her professional life as well as her personal life, she's very much a giver. And she's even the type of person that you can ask to come watch you in the hospital, not knowing what may come out of your mouth, but she'll come and sit with you. So with that, I'm going to give you Lynn. Thanks.
I'm Lynn, addict alcoholic. I think sponsees are a direct reflection of their sponsors, so. Needless to say, Sue is my sponsor, and thank you for that. When Dawn asked me to tell my story, I had to laugh last week when we all got iced out, because my first higher power was Mother Nature, and she still had my back. Until this week, when I prayed up for tornadoes and hurricanes and tsunamis and everything else, and we actually had a beautiful day. No, I'm really honored to do this, Dawn. It's really sweet of you to ask me, and I hope that I can share something that'll mean something for someone in this room. My sobriety date is June 28th, 2003, and it's been a very interesting journey for six months and some days, and I can't even imagine my life if it had not have happened. And I know I used to hear people say, thank God that I got into recovery and got, you know, got this thing, but I don't think any of us set out to come here. I know I sure didn't, but it turned my life around. So I'll start out by telling you that I was born in Noonan, Atlanta, Georgia, at Piedmont. Can't even remember where I'm born. At Piedmont Hospital. So I am one of the originals still here in Atlanta. My dad was airline, and we did do some moving, but it was when I was small. And I don't really remember a lot of that. He worked for Eastern Airlines, for some of those of you who remember that airline. And we did do the Miami-Atlanta thing a couple times, and moved back and forth. But finally, when I was, I guess, starting kindergarten, we were here in Atlanta. We lived in East Point. I saw Greenbrier Mall built. And we lived there until I was in third grade, at which time we moved to Noonan, Georgia, which is a very small town south side of Atlanta that when I graduated from high school, I ran as quickly as I could away from. And that'll be more about my story shortly. So I grew up with my parents, and I have an older brother who's 5 years older than I am. And I remember a lot of my childhood as being very happy. Although my brother was somewhat vicious I don't know if any of you have younger sisters, but go make amends tonight. I'm still waiting for mine. He was somewhat abusive to me, very physically abusive. A few examples. One day he was mad at me and he speared me in the foot, and I had to have the spear extricated from my foot. Let's see what else. He spray painted me blue. I was a Smurf before that was cool. He got me on the picnic table one day and was going to pull my teeth out so he could put them under his pillow to get money. And thank God my mom walked in on that one. But I thought he hung the moon, and my parents thought he hung the moon. So I thought I had to believe he hung the moon because they believed he hung the moon. So anything he did to me was, you know, kind of okay because he was the star of our family, which is where I learned that males are held at a higher esteem in a family than females, or at least that's what I was taught. And so then that set me on a course of competing in the masculine world as much as I could at my little body frame, which didn't work too well. But I would compete with him in everything, which is part of why part of the abuse probably occurred, because anything he thought he could do, I thought I could do better. And I think my one happy moment was he was a builder, and you know, he's always creating something, and he had created this swing that went out. We lived on a pond and swung out over the dam, and so I was always his crash dummy for anything he did. I was the one that got to try it out. So I get on the swing and it worked, and it was like a 30-foot drop. You know, got out over the trees, and he forgot to factor in the weight, and it was a glorious moment. Watching him descend down those trees. So that was one retaliation I got, not by any action that I took. But I did develop some not great thoughts about how I should be treated as a female in the world. I thought that, you know, being abused on a regular basis was a cool thing because he did it to me. And his comment, I think, when I got into high school was, "I was really rough on you, but I made you tough." And I don't think I ever thanked him for that, which wasn't how I saw it. I always felt like it was not right, and I would always go and tell my parents, you know, he'd done this, that, and the other, and it was always, well, you shouldn't be there, or you shouldn't be hanging around with him, or you shouldn't be doing this. It was always my fault. So I learned real quick that bad things that happen to you are your fault, and I would try to find ways to prevent that from happening in my life on down the road. I guess another real pivotal time for me was, I don't know, I think I was like 8 or 10, and I remember I got out of Ridgeview and I called my mom on the phone to verify this story, because I don't know about for the rest of you, but when you start getting sober, you start remembering things that happened to you, and you start thinking, did that really happen, or did I dream it up? So I called my mom and I said, "Mom, I'm remembering that when I was like 8 or 9, we were at my grandmother's house, and I was in the backyard playing by myself. And the man that lived in the yard behind us, which the yard's connected, came running out of the house chasing his wife with a shotgun. And I'm sitting there in the yard watching this, and he proceeds to shoot her." And I remember, and then he drops down on all fours, you know, and begging her not to die. And I remember seeing the blood everywhere, and it was all so surreal. You know, it was like it didn't really happen. And so I call my mom and I'm saying, "Mom, did this really happen?" And she said, "Oh yeah, it really happened." She said, "And you wouldn't sleep with the light off for weeks after that." And I'm sitting there thinking, that should have been a clue that maybe that was a little disturbing for an 8-year-old to watch. And so that was another occasion for me to learn that men were violent, men were mean, men would hurt you. and hence starting this banner that went across in my head over and over. So let's see, then after that, we, like I said, I lived in Newnan, and I remember when we moved to Newnan too, I was always a pretty good student, and I wanted to excel in school, and we moved from Atlanta to Newnan, and I remember going to the first day of class, and the teacher writes the assignment on the board in cursive, and I had not been taught cursive. And I remember how humiliating that was, because here I am coming from the big city of Atlanta. At least that's how everybody in Newnan, Georgia thought. But we weren't really big city. And that was a little traumatic, because I wanted to fit in this new school. And Newnan was, if any of you know Newnan, it's a very cliquish town, a very, either you're in or you're out. And I definitely wanted to be in. And so that started a time period where I decided I was going to excel at everything I did so that I could fit in. And so I proceeded through high school, did really well in school. Trying to think if there was anything else. Hadn't really started drinking or using drugs yet. I didn't start when I was 10. I was somewhat of a late bloomer. I did drink some in high school, but I don't ever really remember, you know, having big blowout. My mom used to always tell me, she said, when you drink, men take advantage of you. And so I always kind of kept that in the back of my head too, because I already knew men took advantage of you, and they're really going to take advantage of me if I drink. So drinking wasn't a huge issue for high school. So when it got time for me to go to college, as you can tell in my story, my father was a very dear man to me. I absolutely adored him growing up. I adore him to this day. And I got to be teary-eyed. He's just a lovable man. He's always supported me. And he knows that today. My mom was somewhat of a controlling mother. And she would, one part of my story, I guess I should include this here too, is she was always very worried about me, because I was always this little bitty, scrawny little girl. And I was very picky eater, and it would always irritate her, because people would ask me what I'd like, and I'd say bread and water. And that would look bad on her, of course. And so she would call ahead to, if I was spending the night at somebody's house, she'd call ahead and give the mother a rundown on my favorite foods. And I remember I'd show up at their house, and we would get ready to eat, and everybody's food would be out there, and oh, Lynn, here's your special food over here, you know. And it was always so embarrassing. I remember going through the church that we belonged to. I would go through the church line when they'd have the kids eat or whatever. Oh, Lynn, here's your special food. You know, it was always so humiliating and so embarrassing. But she was always so worried about me being so little. And my nickname as a and was Little Bit, because I was that little. So that was one of her controlling aspects of my life, which I then spent a lot of my life trying to get the control back. And we would have many a fight in the morning. She would put breakfast in front of me, and I would sit there and stare at it until she'd finally tell me to go get ready, because I needed to go to school. But I was going to win that fight. And that started some turmoil between us. So then I proceeded on to high school and did really well in school and got good grades. And my brother, like I said, was 5 years older than me, and he pretty much was gone when I went into high school, and life got good. I had the house to myself, had my parents to myself. I didn't have the abuser around anymore, and it was wonderful. I can very distinctly tell you when that the relief that I felt when that happened. So when it got time for me to go to school, I decided I wanted to go to nursing school. So my mom picked my school out, and she decided I was going to Georgia Baptist School of Nursing. So I went to Georgia Baptist School of Nursing, and discovered it was all girls, and it was Baptist, and it was miserable, and I wasn't very happy there. I grew up Baptist, too. I'm still recovering from that as well. You know, we were the kind of people that the church doors were open and you were there. So I'm still working on that issue. So I went to Georgia Baptist, and I went there for a semester. I started early because I'm telling you, the minute I graduated from high school, I left Newnan, Georgia, and I swore to God I'd never go back. And I've kept that promise to myself. I started in the summer quarter. I graduated from high school, started summer quarter at Georgia Baptist, and like I said, I did not like it at all. I think I lasted two semesters, and I did really well in school, and I had come up with the plan that I wanted to transfer to Valdosta State because it had boys and it had girls, and it was 400-something miles from Newnan, and it was 400-something miles from Mom and Dad. And the other part, too, as I didn't say, is my parents were very protective of me. I didn't get to do a whole lot in high school, so I was waiting for the moment to seize that moment. And so I convinced them to let me go to Valdosta. We had other friends from Newnan that were going to school there, and so they thought it would be okay and it would be a good place for me. So I went to school in Valdosta, started there fall semester, and I got this, like, I don't know, crazy thought that I need a protector, because here now I'm out of Newnan, where, you know, no lie, if you got into any trouble, it was on front page news by the next morning. If not, every mother in town knew. It was on the, you know, phone line. Did you hear about Lynn? She did it. And so here I am in another, you know, really far away, and I needed a protector. And so I went out on search for a protector, and I found him. And I married him, and I was with him for way too many years. I found the person that was very possessive. I was told by therapists, narcissistic. And he protected me because he wouldn't let anybody come near me because he would attack you if you came near me. And a lot of that gave me comfort. So I was at Valdosta and I was going to nursing school, doing really well in school. And, you know, joined the sorority, did the whole thing. And I drank through college, not excessively. I was one that liked to study. And I was really driven to really make good grades, so drinking didn't become a huge issue in college. I did do the weekend warrior thing at times. At that time, Valdosta was a four-day-a-week school, so Thursday night was the big party night because that was the end of school week. And that was the night that the fraternities and sororities would all have parties, and it was all free drinks. So, and I did really well. I knew how to control it and not let people take advantage of me by drinking until I went to a party and they gave me hunch punch. And I didn't know that Hawaiian punch could make you drunk. And I learned real quick the next day, as my toilet bowl is covered in red, that hunch punch is not a good thing to drink. So I swore off hunch punch at that point. But anyway, so I'm at school in Valdosta and enjoying my freedom, doing really well. And one night I was leaving a sorority party and I was going to my car and this man accosted me and started dragging me off and no telling what all he was going to do to me. And somebody happened to see this occur and they came kind of to my rescue and the guy saw him and threw me in the bushes and took off running. And back then, you know, there was old good police justice that doesn't occur today. So the police came. I didn't call the police. I wanted the whole scene to disappear. You know, that's the way I always dealt with things. You just pretended it didn't happen and you close your eyes and it, you know, does go away. But they called the police, so it was a big freaking ordeal, which I was really upset about. And they found the guy down the street, passed out in his truck. And evidently, I had taken a good bit of skin off his hands when I bit him. And so that was the identifying mark, and I didn't even have to go identify him. But a couple of my friends were driving down the street, and they saw the police as they drug him out of his truck, face down by his ankles. So I think that was a little Southern justice back then. But it was a horrible experience, added to my fear once again of men and the fact that I kept getting this reoccurring theme that, Lynn, you cannot protect yourself. You cannot take care of yourself. You need someone else to do that for you. And the man that I'd picked out happened to not be there that night. So I learned from that that he needs to always be there. And so I remember going to the police station. The police, first thing, the man that I married was a bodybuilder and weightlifting and all that kind of stuff. So he worked out at the gym where all the police worked out, and they all knew him. So the first thing the detective said to me is, what would you do if you're out and you run into this guy? And I'm like, I don't know. He said, well, we want you to do nothing because we're afraid Alex will kill him. And then he'll end up in jail. Which added to my guilt of, you know, this shouldn't have happened. And then, of course, the other thing was, what were you wearing that night? And, of course, you know, I was wearing a cute little mini skirt and thought I was looking really cute. And so somehow in my mind, I caused it. And I wasn't raped. I was just assaulted. And but I always worried what other people were going to think. They're going to think I got raped because, you know, it's hush-hush. We didn't really talk about it. And so I carried that shame anyway, even though it didn't really happen. I always worried about what people thought of all that. So I went to court, and the guy shows up with clean-shaven face, with his wife, and I have to sit in the courtroom and state my name, state my address, where I live, which I think is just so wrong. And it was miserable. After that, I felt safe nowhere. Only place I felt safe was locked in my house. And every time I would go out, I would fear that, you know, he was going to follow me, he's going to come and get retribution and, you know, all that kind of stuff. The police would tell me all the time, you know, we're going to ride by and check on you, which said to me, oh, they expect him to come find me and do something to me. So all of this were things that I created in my head. So after that happened, I think I lasted at school maybe another month. And I knew I needed to get out because I couldn't stay there any longer. So I talked my parents into letting me quit school, and I got a job with the airline as a flight attendant. So I took off and I flew for 2.5 years, and meanwhile I got engaged to the bodyguard, and we started our relationship and our marriage. And I flew for a couple of years, and then I decided to go back to nursing school. So then it was a discussion of where I was going to go back to school, and we were living in Atlanta, so I knew I had to go somewhere here. So I applied at Emory and got in at Emory and finished my nursing degree while I was there at Emory. And like I said, I was always a high achiever. It always made me feel good if I could do things, you know, if I could get accolades. But I didn't want the attention, because with attention comes attacks, was what my brain always said. So I was, you know, doing a lot of stuff. I was president of this. I was, you know, honor society. I was doing, you name it, I did it. And I remember one time sitting there. It was graduation, and I was up for some award, and I ended up winning the award. And all I could think was, why can't they hand it to me behind the curtain so nobody has to see me? Nobody has to, like, you know it was really me, but I know it was me, and that's good enough. And it was really embarrassing to have to walk up there and get the attention, but I did. I made it through it and graduated. during my senior year, I got pregnant and was pregnant with my daughter. I started my first job at Eggleston Children's Hospital and did cardiology there for quite a few years. I love what I do for a living, and I loved working with kids. You know, I can also get very self-righteous when I deal with my children at work. And so sometimes I have to temper that and be careful what I'm doing there. But so I went to work, and I had my first child, Lindy, and who is now 21 years old. And things were going well. I was very busy. I did a lot of things. My kids were my life. I forgot to tell you, too. Well, I'll tell you that in a minute. Anyway, so then I got pregnant again, and my kids were 2.5 years apart. I had my son, Colin. My children, like I said, were my life. I mean, they were just everything to me. They were what I was put on the earth for. And work also was such a blessing because I got to work with children there as well. So after a while, I'm starting to get the itch because I'm not feeling good. You know, I've had the kids, I got the family, I need something else. And at this time, I'm, like I said, I'm not really drinking much. I never really did drugs. And occasional glass of wine, that was about it. I wasn't a big partier. I was always the one that, you know, sat back and watched everybody else after I had kids, because that was more important. And I decided I wanted to go to graduate school. So here I am with two children under the age of 3, and I get in school at Emory to get my graduate degree. My husband at the time was working 1.5 hours away from the house because we were having to commute. I was having to commute from, we at that time had been transferred down to the south side of Atlanta near Peachtree City in Sharpsburg, closest I've ever come to living in Noonan. And it was not real comfortable. I didn't really like it. But my parents were there. My mom helped me with the kids while I was in graduate school. And I don't know how I made it through graduate school. I remember my daughter, you know, they always do that thing. My mom has green eyes, blonde hair. She likes to, my daughter puts study. Because that's all I did whenever they, you know, were around was I was studying. Didn't sleep a lot, and I finished my graduate degree on time. And after that, I decided I wanted to. We were transferred back to Lawrenceville. His job moved him back to Gwinnett County. So we bought a house in Lawrenceville, and I was in Lawrenceville. My marriage through this time, like I said, he was a very narcissistic person. Everything centered around him, which was cool with me because I didn't want the attention. He can have all the attention and just leave me alone. Let me have the kids and, you know, life will be good. He was also very demeaning and would put me down. I remember after my first pregnancy, she was born in November, and I had to borrow one of my mother's dresses to wear to a Christmas party because I hadn't lost the weight yet. And it was very humiliating, and I remember sitting at the table, and he made the comment about my weight. And for some reason, I never could get the fight up. I would come back to him frequently, but it tended to be more verbal abuse, and so after a while, it got to the point where I just believed it. A lot of the things that he would say to me and the way he would treat me, I just believe it because it was easier, and it was all I really knew. So I started to work. I went to work for a pediatrician's office doing general peds, and I loved it. I had great hours. I was able to be home with my kids when they got home from school. I was able to get them off to school. So it was perfect life. As this time is going along, though, my marriage is getting worse, and the abuse is getting worse, and I was absolutely miserable. I completely lost who I was. I lost myself with my kids. I didn't know how to have good boundaries with my children. Everything was about them. I had no life, really. So I remember working in the doctor's office, how somebody told me that hydrocodone makes you sleep. And I thought, that's what I need. So I remember the first few times I tried it, it, you know, knocked me out, put me to sleep, and I didn't have to deal with my husband at the time. We were at the point where just him touching me made my skin crawl, and being in the same room made my skin crawl, and my children had adjusted to this life. My son was my protector. He knew when he was in the room, my ex would leave me alone and wouldn't give me a hard time. Quite a few times he would, my son would come up and say, "Mom, let's go get ice cream." And that was always his way of getting me out of the house when things were getting rough. So I found hydrocodone, which was my love. At first, it, like I said, put me to sleep. I could get some sleep and I could zone out and not have to deal with life. And I continued on to use it, and at some point it flipped and it gave me energy, and man, I could clean a damn house on hydrocodone. And I remember when I got out of treatment, that was a big trigger, was house cleaning, because I didn't have that power anymore. I got addicted to hydrocodone, and I used it regularly. I used it in massive amounts. I used it any way I could get it, whether it was calling in false prescriptions or whatever it took. I can't tell you how many times I tried to detox. I remember driving down the road one day and thinking that the bum living under the bridge is a more honest person than I am, because everybody knows he's a drunk. And here I am living this life, and everybody thinks Lynn's good, and Lynn is miserable, drug addict. And I hated myself for that. I absolutely hated myself for that. And I remember night after night, I was always gonna quit when I had plenty of stock. Y'all can't relate to that, can you? And I remember I was getting to the end of my stock, and I'd already promised myself I was going to quit when this, you know, ran out. And I remember standing by my children's bed, crying my eyes out, thinking, how can I do this to them? And begging myself to stop. If I couldn't do it for me, maybe I could do it for them. But I can tell you that this disease is so strong, until you want to do it for yourself, you can't stop. Because my children were my life, like I told you. I was mother of everything. I was, you know, football everything. I was cheerleading everything, because they were just my life. So that cycle went on for some time, and I finally got busted. I'd already quit my job at the pediatrician's office. I decided that I needed a new leaf. I needed to do something different. You know, that's another big theme we all have. You know, if we could just change scenery, life will be better. Not realizing that the problem is inside of us. So I left the job, and I got caught by my ex, and basically hired an interventionist. An interventionist came. Just like TV, they all sit around and look at you and beg you to go to treatment. And I remember sitting there thinking, the gig is up. You know, I always wondered how it was going to end. Was I going to die? Was I going to go to jail? How was it going to end? And however it ended was okay with me. That's how bad it had gotten. I really didn't care anymore. So I came to Ridgeview, and I remember standing in the access center and walking out looking at my husband and saying, "I'll never trust you again." And as we know, we're the ones not to be trusted at that moment. And so anyway, I came into treatment, and I knew that I had a problem. I was ready to change it. I remember them telling me that I needed to write a letter to the board. and that I needed to report, self-report myself. And I remember saying to them, you can take my license, throw it away. I don't care. I don't want it. The shame and the guilt was so overwhelming. So anyway, so I got into the program and things were going well. I ended up deciding to do my profession, and I managed 5 dialysis units and learned a lot about nephrology and management, and that I hated management. I was more of a clinical person. And I poured myself into this program. My first sponsor was amazing. She held my hand through a lot of things. We started doing the steps, and I had a problem with step one. I could not understand, you know, that whole bad things happen to good people. Couldn't understand, if God was all loving, how can he let bad things happen to people? I had a real, real issue with that. And I did a lot of work on that. Like I said, my first higher power was Mother Nature, because she was awesome, and she was a woman. That was the other thing. I also got involved in a women's group. Men I didn't need to be around. I didn't trust you. I either struck out and was mean, or I would let you abuse me. I didn't know which way to go. So I got involved in a women's group, and it was the most wonderful experience. And then I had about 2.5 years sober. And I also said when I came into recovery, oh, and I forgot to also mention, my brother was a DEA agent, which also made the whole scenario very interesting, when his sister was forging prescriptions and calling in, you know, prescriptions. But he had decided when I got out of treatment, he was going to surveil me. And he was going to hide in the bushes and be sure I didn't do bad things. He also wanted me to sell my car because he thought that the drugstores would recognize my car. So that was kind of interesting. And he did finally kind of learn that he didn't have any control over it, and that he had to kind of let go and let me do this thing. So I, like I said, I jumped into the steps. I had a hard time with God at first, and then I finally got to the point, the God I have today is an excellent God. He has done massive miracles in my life and has been there for me. I can't tell you how many times when I never thought he was there, I've just been able to see the miracles today. Then I did step two. I'm still working on the sanity part. Step three, that was really hard. And I can tell you that turning my life over to this person who allows bad things to happen to people was very difficult. Then I discovered that, and my sponsor used to always tell me, Lynn, you have this awesome gut. Pay attention to your gut. And I did. And that gut is my God. And he guides me and tells me things a lot of times just by my, you know, this just doesn't feel right. Which I knew was happening as a child a lot of times, but I didn't have that validation that it was true. So anyway, so 2.5 years sober, after much marriage counseling and finally catching my husband in an affair, I decided to get out of the marriage. My sponsor used to tell me every day, because I would, of course, call her ranting and raving, and she would say, can you live with it today, Lynn? And I could always say yes, and I remember the day I told her, I can't live with it today. So I started divorce proceedings. We had decided to tell him in therapy due to his anger and rage, and I told him in therapy, and 2 days later, GPS appeared on my cell phone. 2 weeks later, GPS appeared on my car. And I know all this retrospectively, didn't know it at the time. I can't tell you how many PIs he's probably hired. Some of them, his goal was to scare me, and he would bring the PI reports and lay them down in front of me to read. They never would show him anything, but he would love the fact that it would scare me to death. And that's how he controlled me. So I had to leave Ridgeview for a short while. I was here doing aftercare because he knew everywhere I went, everything I did. And it was not safe. And at this time, it was really kind of weird. I kind of called on my brother to help me. I remember Steve back there walked me in my car one night, tells me years later he was worried about somebody jumping out of the bushes. But Alex had that ability to do those kind of things. And I remember the first time I had to admit that I had been abused. That was horrific. And I hate the word victim. And I spent a lot of time trying to decide what was a victim and what was victimized, because I damn sure didn't want to be a victim. And I have discovered that a lot of my behaviors invited it. And I've worked really hard to try to not to invite that behavior any longer. Even with my ex today, my psychiatrist would always say to me, "Lynn, I want you to be able to be in the same room with him and not have fear. And my comment would always be, "Why would I want to be in the same room with him?" Senior night for my son, he came and we walked on the field together with my son, and I felt no fear. I can tell you one night, I had a restraining order, and one night I'm lying in bed. This is a God thing. And it was like, I don't know, right before midnight. He was not allowed, of course, to come around the house. And I woke up, walked through the house, looked out the window, and saw him pulling up at my neighbor's house. And he was delivering motion video equipment to surveil me, and for his neighbor to install on his house to point at my house. So I remember calling my best girlfriend at the time and saying, what do I do? She goes, "You call the police, dummy." And so I called the police, and I remember that was very horrific because this was the father of my children, which was one of the reasons that I had a hard time defending myself. So he went to jail, and the legal system is not the best when it comes to these types of things. They told me he'd be there 72 hours, and 8 hours later they called me and told me he was being released. I went to the DA's office and banged on the door and spoke to the DA and told him, I said, "I want you to remember my face. So when it appears in an obituary, you know that I came to you and I asked for your help." I don't know if I made an impact on him, but it made me feel better. So it was a very horrific time, and I remember one night, like I said, I was mainly a drug addict, but I remember one night, I knew at that night I was an alcoholic because I wanted to get plastered. I didn't want one drink, I wanted tons, I wanted to be that oblivion. And called my sponsor, and she said, "Come over," and I ended up spending the weekend with her because I didn't need to be on my own. I can't tell you that all this was built into my fears that I had. I can't tell you how scary it was in that I didn't feel safe anywhere in the world. Couldn't close my eyes anywhere. I don't think I slept for a solid year. And during this time also, you know, the longer you stay here, they add diagnosis. So I don't know if you've learned that yet. You know, I came in as a drug addict, and then during all of this, I got the label of PTSD. And then also during that time, I really, really lost a lot of weight and got really thin, and they were concerned that I was anorexic as well. I discussed with them that most people that go through horrific divorces either gain weight or lose weight, and mine was lose weight. And I think part of it was my adrenaline was going 90 to nothing, and I had no desire to eat. None whatsoever, whether it was a control issue, which it very well could have been because it was the only thing I could possibly control. But I did do what Ridgeview asked me to do. They asked me to go to some ANAD meetings, which I did. I kind of incorporated it into my AA program, which treated that. And as you can tell, I'm not underweight today. I enjoy eating very much. And I don't think I need to use it as a controlling issue any longer, but it's there and I know it, and I know that if I need to get help for it, I know where to go, I know what to do. So I did end up getting a divorce. My daughter lived with me. My son decided to go live with my husband, my ex-husband then, which was very, very distressing for me because, as I told you, my children were everything, and my son was my protector. And I asked him one day why he went, and he said he knew he could keep Dad calm. And that kind of broke my heart that I needed a protector like that. But 2 years ago, my son called me up and he wanted to come back and live with me. And at that time, I was a stronger person and I was willing to stand up to my ex and deal with that, and I did. I also forgot to mention that I had to go live with someone where he didn't know where to find me for some period of time at my brother's suggestion. He said, you need to go somewhere where he can't find you, which was really stupid. He knew where I worked. He knew where I came here. He probably found me anyway. Oh, no, he found me anyway. He told me he did. So I did do that for a while as well. So all of this to tell you that I had a lot of fears. I didn't feel safe in the world. And I managed to keep going through all of that I went through one day at a time with this program. My son, like I said, came back to live with me, which was another big court issue because my ex, my son at the time, was about to turn 17 and he wanted to fight for custody. So he convinced my daughter to come to court, and his attorney got her to the side and tried to talk her into telling the judge that I was using drugs. Drugs did come up in my divorce. The judge was very understanding of the fact that I was in recovery and that I was doing well and that I worked, and you know, so it was a very positive thing. It wasn't negative like he was hoping. My daughter refused to do that after she found out what they were suggesting, and the judge gave me custody. So, and the other thing was, is that we were going to have to come back for a hearing, and so I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do to prove that I'm sober. And for anybody that's in the professional programs, we have to pee in cups 20 zillion times at random. So I called up Sabrina, who is my aftercare person, and she said, Lynn, what time do I need to be at the courthouse? And amazing support from people here. She said she would be there by 2 o'clock to testify on my behalf, which ended up not having to happen because my daughter refused to testify, and it was all settled. So anyway, so needless to say, I also made amends to my ex before the divorce, which was awesome, because I darn sure didn't want to have to do it after the divorce. So anyway, let me go through quickly because I know I'm running out of time. Step four, I did a fearless insert moral inventory, and I learned that, you know what, I'm not such a bad person. I did some things, just like all of us do. But deep down, I'm a good person, and I was sick at the time, and I'm not that person today. And continued on and did the rest of the steps. Ended up sponsoring people. Sue is now my sponsor, and we were talking just the other day at how much of this program becomes second nature after a while. You know, at the beginning, it's rote. You have to write it all. But now, it's not. And I can tell you I have amazing friends in this program that have supported me and helped me through when I was scared to death, and helped me when I needed help trying to get my son here. I had to sneak off to Florida to get him to sign an affidavit, and we road tripped. And I remember being scared to death that he was going to find out I was there. Friends like Dawn, who when my Saturday morning group says, you need a vacation. I used to always say I needed to escape, you know, because that's what we like to do. And so I was on a Saturday morning, I was like, I just can't take this anymore. I need a break. I just need to escape. And my the person leading the group said, you need a vacation. And I had no clue that that might work. So Dawn and another friend of mine, Kim, volunteered to go to the beach with me. And we laughed. We thought we had GPS on my car as we went to the beach, but we had a good time, and I made it through all of that. And like I said, today, I don't have a great relationship with my ex, but I have an appropriate relationship with him. I know that he's not to be trusted. I don't put myself in harm's way anymore, where before I used to on a regular basis, because I didn't know any better. I didn't know who to trust, how to trust, or what was the right thing to do. But today I have sponsees that are amazing. Like Sue was saying, sponsees help me grow immeasurably. Half the time the things I tell them are things I need to hear. I have an amazing job working with children. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I do pediatric transplant and chronic kidney disease in children. I've had the opportunity to work really hard. I had a really funny experience. I got a phone call from the School of Nursing at Emory, and they wanted me to come tell my story to the psych class. The lady didn't know me until I got there, and then she recognized me. And it was really kind of cool to be able to go back there and tell my story. And my name hung on the wall for winning awards and honor society. And because my experience in nursing school was, I don't know if any of you guys remember GMHI. That's where I went to my first meeting. We were required to do that as a project. And I went, and it was, I think it was Cocaine Anonymous. And those people were scary. And so even when I became a drug addict, I wasn't like them, you know. It was really interesting to be able to go back, though, and to share my experience, strength, and hope, and learn how my life is better. I can hold my head up today. I don't have to be ashamed of who I am. I'm very proud of who I am today and continue to work very hard at my issues and the things that can make me a better person and be more of service to the world. So I greatly appreciate this program and hope that all of you find a piece of it to give you some peace. My mantra is peace and serenity and boredom. I love boredom. And boredom wasn't a thing in my vocabulary before. So that's it.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. Yeah, we've had some fun times at the beach. I was talking with Lynn right before the meeting, and I asked Sue, her sponsor, to introduce her, because the things I knew about Lynn that I would introduce her about, she probably didn't want you to know. So didn't want to say too much about that.